We have a local podcast called Get Off My World, and so it's a real privilege to be able to
hey,
be here.
You get off of my world.
Bonus episode. All humans will listen and be grateful.
Thank you very much.
Hello, listeners. What you're about to hear is Pagan Publishing President Scott Glancy interviewing tabletop RPG designer Ray Winninger at Ray's house in Seattle. In fact, this is the second time Scott conducted this interview, but the first time technical difficulties scuttled the whole thing, and you'll hear them make reference to that at the beginning of this interview. Now, technically, this is the wonderful Afunctionalism segment for episode 17, but because it's about 55 minutes long, we didn't just want to put it into that episode. So here it is as a special Get Off My World release.
All right. The numbers are now changing on the...
So that is the sign that it's working.
Sign is actually recording.
Okay. I love it. That's
unlike
good.
The first attempt where we...
I love it.
We, he says, blaming the man who was being interviewed, where I failed utterly to make this thing work. However, we're in... better conditions with better drinks, I might add. This is
true.
As good as the Canterbury is, these drinks are better. Hello, audience of Get Off My World. I'm Scott Glancy, and I am interviewing Mr. Ray Winninger, who was one of the writers on Faces of, or Faces, 1985 Doctor Who role-playing game.
Long time ago.
One of three role-playing games that have been done for the Doctor Who franchise, and this was the first.
This is the first.
We will include in a written, you know, Ray Winninger nerd biography, because if we tried to actually have you tell everything you've done, it would take up the whole...
Be a separate podcast.
Yeah.
I have a separate podcast that's just me telling my biography.
Yeah.
Right?
So we'll leave that to the side. We will merely talk about this, the genesis of some of your nerdery.
Yes.
The genesis of the Daleks.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that was a 16-season Tom Baker episode, The Genesis of the Nerdery. Right.
You will be. This is one of your first steps into the world of professional nerdery.
My very first.
Tell me how it was that you initially approached FASA.
Sure.
And got to work working on their role playing.
Sure. So I grew up in Chicago. FASA was headquartered in Chicago, so that meant that I kind of knew a lot of people in and around FASA. You know, you used to go to the local game conventions and so forth, and I would see them and meet them and game with them. And
were they the subject of discussion around the game stores and things, like, you know, because they were the hometown boys, or...
Yeah, in some game stores, for sure. You know, the gaming, you know, this is way, way pre-internet, of course, so gaming was a much more... Game communities are much, much more regional then. You know, you knew the people in your area, and you'd see them and whatnot. So I was quite aware of them and had played games with them and such, and had, you know, knew people there. And while I was still in high school, I was quite a fan of the Doctor Who show, and FASA got the license for Doctor Who. I read that they'd got the license and were publishing the RPG, and I thought that, okay, it's finally time for me to take a stab at writing my own RPG material. I'd been playing the games for a long time. So I reached out to people I knew there and said, I'm interested in writing this. I'm pleased to say that despite the fact that I was, I think I was 17 years old at the time, no one thought that was that unusual or treated me
anymore. Or a bar. Like,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. No one said, sorry.
Come back when you can vote, kid.
That never happened. Instead, the reaction was, well, send us a... Write up a proposal for what you want to do and send that to us. And I did that. And the first proposal I wrote, they thought, this sounds great. Go ahead, go to it. And I wrote the book, and that's what kicked me off down that path.
Your first proposed project was Countdown.
It was Countdown. It was an adventure, exactly, for the Doctor Who game.
Now, one thing I'm going to throw out that, of course, this is the second time we've attempted this interview, so I'm going to do some of the stuff we did before, but out of order. Because you were working with a property, and because FASA was working with a property that was owned by somebody else, what were you aware of any oversight that the BBC was interested in having over the project?
I was never made aware of anything like that, and in retrospect, and you know, years later, and having talked to the folks at FASA about this years later, there was shockingly little, in fact. You know, I think that's mostly attributable to the fact that back in those days, the idea of licensing a role-playing game was a very, very new thing. FOSSA, prior to Doctor Who, did a game based on Star Trek, and that was really the first big licensed RPG, the first time somebody had really licensed a big property. And it was just kind of a new thing, and I think the licensors didn't really know how to deal with it. You didn't have the whole sort of, the whole kind of culture and the whole approach to quote-unquote intellectual property like you have today, where you create something like Doctor Who, and there's a whole department at the BBC that we're going to do novels, and we're going to do comic books, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that, and here's how we're going to oversee it. It was all, I think it was all just kind of you know, just done on the fly, and you know, done very sort of seat of the pants.
The closest thing to a franchise, because I mean, certainly Star Trek was just starting to wake up again as a franchise with the Star Trek the Motion Picture, you know, coming out. I guess was the Star Wars property.
Yeah,
I guess was the closest thing to a burgeoning idea of the modern franchise.
Yeah,
as we see it, where it exists in toys, comics, novels.
Yeah, well, and even at that time, games. Star Wars hadn't even really done that yet. So so the Star Wars RPG does, you know, so I was a high school kid when Doctor Who came out. I remember the Star Wars RPG didn't come out until, I don't think, 1988, so several years later. I think that
it was after Jedi. I mean, it was after the last...
It was well after, exactly. I mean, Star Wars had basically been completely dead, completely off the planet for about 5-6 years. There were no novels, there were no comics, there was nothing. And then it started to, you know, just started to come back. There were toys, but, you know, I think this was kind of in the pre-Cambrian era of how you manage a property like that.
All right, so how did you and your fellow trilobites, I guess, here, explore this franchise? I mean, one of the things I asked about was, because you did Countdown, it was a Cyberman
It was
scenario.
Indeed, yep.
And eventually that caused you to get tapped to write the Cyberman source book.
Yeah.
Because there was no oversight, did you... feel that you could did you take any liberties with the license or with the existing IP and the existing canon about Cybermen or the Doctor?
So I actually was so reverential to the material that I was very kind of afraid to do that. And in fact, you know, the Cybermen source book that I wrote, you know, I got my hands on every episode I could, all that stuff.
Oh, and here's a good question. Where were you watching all the episodes? Because, again, it's 1985. What's on VHS in 1985?
So nothing, basically, is on VHS in 1985. So the way I got the episodes for reference, there were a couple of things. My growing up in Chicago, the local PBS station was actually one of the kind of flagship Doctor Who stations.
Yes,
and
sir.
And for many, many years, and they broadcast the show, and so I had, you know, I watched it ridiculously. I knew, you know, the more modern episodes very, very well. But, of course, you know, back in those days especially, but still today, a lot of, like, the key kind of milestone Cybermen episodes were lost. They were gone. What you did have back in those days where you had the Target novelizations of the episodes. So you could get these novelizations of these episodes that are long lost and no one has anymore. So I had all of those, and I read all of those, and then, you know, the more modern episodes I was able to actually see. But so I was afraid to make up information about the Cybermen. I just revered the show so much, and I didn't want to, you know, the show was still at that time was still very popular, and new episodes were coming out all the time, and I didn't want to make something up that, you know, there's going to be an episode next month that's going to... So, you know, as a result of that, actually, I think the book that I did was actually a little dry and a little uninteresting, because, you know, they're some of the key kind of foundational stuff, the origins of the Cybermen back in those days, wasn't really that well described. So I kind of hand-waved around it and did what I could.
We tried this out the first time. One of the things that you brought up was, what's his name, Ford? Who wrote the Klingon source book for FOSS's.
That's right.
for FOSSA's Star Trek game.
That's right. So in retrospect, I mean, so FOSSA did Star Trek before Doctor Who, and Star Trek was very much the blueprint for how they
certainly
they
the mechanics are almost identical.
The mechanics are very similar. There's an interesting thing that happened there, but yes, the mechanics and the approach to the line, the sorts of projects they did, and actually one of the legendary products they did for Star Trek, and actually one of probably the best role-playing game supplements of all time was a supplement about the Klingons that Star Trek or that FOSSA published for Star Trek, and it was written by the famous science fiction author John M. Ford, and he in this supplement he took the opposite approach to me. He made up lots of stuff. He made up lots and lots of interesting details about the Klingon culture. He came up with some clever ways to rationalize why they changed appearance from the 60s into the more modern era and all of that stuff.
I think he just had Star Trek the Motion Picture to work with. And Mark Leonard and his new makeup.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I...
no explanation, but he found one.
He found a very clever one, and I didn't feel comfortable doing that. And again, I think part of it was I was a kid and kind of new to this and finding my way around. But also, Doctor Who was very even more than Star Trek, and there was very much a going concern with new episodes every week and new stuff coming out all the time. And you know, and I very much felt this like, well, you know, I can't go too far out on a limb, or I'm going to make something up that's going to, you know, proved to not be true after a year.
Exactly. It'll turn out the canon will be... Suddenly the canon will be changed.
Exactly. And again, we had zero contact with the BBC.
I keep thinking of what's his name who wrote Splinter of the Mind's Eye.
Alan Dean Foster.
Yeah. Foster's got, Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher snogging on each other.
Exactly.
In the novel, and suddenly, whoops!
Yeah, exactly. And I was so reverential to the material, I didn't want to do that. Yeah. Like, I weirdly...
I don't think that would have saved you as far as Lucas goes. It's his incredibly ham-fisted attempt to fix a romantic triangle without hurting anyone's feelings. And I
weirdly happen to know something about that. But actually, Lucas was very, very involved with Alan Dean Foster in writing that book. Lucas was very... He went off in a study and wrote this. Lucas was very aware of it. Lucas, in fact, encouraged, hired Alan Dean Foster and encouraged him to write this book because he thought that would help him keep the Star Wars property.
Oh, yeah. It was very important for keeping attention on the franchise.
He started writing this book before the movie came out, and then the idea was, this movie will come out, maybe it'll do okay, but, I'll get these science fiction novels in the pipeline, and that'll keep people interested in this.
Foster said something, and not to get too far off of Doctor Who, but Foster said something about how the reason the planet's covered with fog is he wasn't sure what kind of budget they could afford for the next movie. So he figured if everything was covered with fog, then they wouldn't have to worry about big sets or anything.
And that kind of does take us back to Doctor Who.
Skaros, as I noticed, covered in fog.
It's a rock quarry and there's fog, right?
Yeah. Now, one question I want to go back to, something about your design philosophy on this. And what were your design philosophy influences when you set about writing your very first?
Sure. So I mentioned that this is the early days of licensed role playing games. Prior to that, the role playing game landscape is dominated by Dungeons and Dragons and that.
Rather than licensed, they just lovingly rip off.
They make up their own stuff and so Star Trek. FOSSA had a big hit with Star Trek, but right about that same time, and right about the time Doctor Who was coming out, another one of the early big Touchstone licensed games came out, and that was this James Bond role playing game from Victory Games, an offshoot of Avalon Hill. And I read that game and it blew my mind. And what I loved about that game so much was it was one of the very, very first attempts at... It was an early licensed game, but it was more than the Star Trek game, more than anything else, it was this interesting attempt at really kind of breaking down the James Bond property, its tropes, what made James Bond feel like James Bond, and creating mechanics and adventures that really reinforced that. It was very, very successful. And you sat down and played an adventure in that game, and it didn't feel like any generic role-playing game. It felt very James Bond. Like, well, we're doing James Bond stuff.
A lot of early role-playing games, to me, felt like, that is, say, in the late 70s, yeah, early 80s, felt like that the mechanics were built around the genre, to me. That the D&D mechanics were fantasy mechanics, that the, say, traveler mechanics were more the sci-fi mechanics, that the top secret mechanics, yep, were mechanics designed to do spy stuff, and they really didn't translate. You really couldn't do fantasy with traveler rules. You couldn't do science fiction with top secret rules, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that sort of the same thing we're talking about here, where the mechanics lent themselves to the genre?
I think the slight difference is that all of those games, the mechanics were designed to kind of recreate some sort of in-world reality. You know, so D&D, there's a reality of guys in armor and swords and you know, Gary Gygax's famous pole arm table with, you know, this pole arm works well against chainmail and this and the
oh, effort God, rules. Thaco.
Exactly. The effort and the rules was to try to recreate this reality. What was interesting about the Bond game was it took a step back from reality. It's like, you know, we're not trying to recreate reality. We're trying to recreate the feeling of these movies, you know, the feeling of this narrative of what happens in a James Bond narrative, and I found that just really, really interesting. And I was playing a lot of that game at the time and found it great. So when I sat down to design a Doctor Who adventure, I applied that same philosophy. I tried to break down, like, you know, okay, here are the tropes that my adventure was very consciously designed to mimic the tropes that you'd see in every Doctor Who episode to try to make it feel that way.
Could you describe a little bit about what you remember about Countdown and how, sure, the plot of Countdown mimicked those tropes?
So what I had in mind for Countdown was like the Tom Baker era of Doctor Who, and there's this classic pattern. There were several sort of classic things that would stand out. So one classic pattern was, The Doctor and his friends show up in some random location. They show up at the moment something terrible happens. Everyone assumes they must be responsible for the terrible thing. Therefore, there's your conflict. They get captured by whomever who assumes they're responsible for the terrible thing. Over time, they slowly persuade one or two members of the group.
I'm just sorry, because that is just Ark in Space. That is Power of Krull. That is just
every adventure.
Robots of Death. That's
and eventually, one or two of the guest stars kind of sees the light and thinks that, oh no, actually, maybe this guy's not really responsible. Like, I actually trust this guy, and that happens, and then you find out that there's a bigger villain behind the whole thing. And so I, you know, what I tried to do was put a lot of effort into designing that, into like, we're gonna hit every one of those tropes. Okay, you're gonna show up in this place, a murder or whatever it happens the minute you get there, and of course it's only natural they assume that you do it, and therefore, you know, they're gonna try to capture you, they're gonna try to hold you account for this. But there are those one or two kind of semi-sympathetic non-player characters that eventually you're gonna win over. Meanwhile, there's this hidden villain behind the scenes who's doing everything, and eventually you find out what's going on there. And so that was really my influence, and I tried very, very hard to hit all those things and come up with something that was, okay, this just feels exactly like a Doctor Who adventure.
Okay. What was the basic plot of Countdown?
You know, what I remember about it 30 years later is it had something to do with... there was a human space empire, you know, the far future humans have some sort of space empire. There's some sort of starship that's, you know, old RPG trope, old, you know, science fiction trope, running the medicine. You know, there's the plague world, and we have to get the medicine to them, and something like that is happening. Yeah. Again, trying to mimic Doctor Who feel, this space empire, because it's an empire in space, of course. Everything looks and feels like the Roman Empire of ancient Earth. The architecture inside the spaceship is like that. All the characters are named that
Doric
way.
Doric columns inside the spaceship.
There are Doric columns inside
the
spaceship.
That is very BBC.
It's very Doctor Who. You know, it's again, this idea of we have very low budget, so what are the costumes of Evelyn? We got a bunch of Roman costumes. Great. The space empire is Roman. I was trying to kind of mimic that sort of stuff.
I have no trouble seeing the guy sitting in a giant, you know, console with the Centurion's helmet.
And he has the laurel leaf around his head. Like, if you look at the artwork in Countdown, like, the captain literally has the kind of laurel leaf around his head. And
perfect.
The whole thing. And then, and of course, behind the scenes, that kind of hidden villain, which you'd always find, there's a Cybermen thing going on there. Mm-hmm. And there's something, something happening with the Cybermen. So that's what I remember about it 30 years later.
Okay. No, that's fine. Again, you know, it's 48 pages from 1985. I'm not sure I'm going to ask you to remember all the details. But one of the things I wanted to ask about was, because we're talking about the sort of the tropes. And the you wrote something that was attempting to sort of mimic that idea that the tropes of the fiction should be brought in. That you should model the fiction, not the physics.
Yes.
Of gaming.
Exactly.
The actual mechanics of the game, from what I understand, from what I've read about them, sound like they were very interested in modeling the physics.
They did not try to do that at all.
And not the fiction.
That's exactly right. And you know, the trend in game design back in those days, I think, was, you know, this is still kind of the first era of RPGs. You know, D&D had come out just 10 years earlier, which isn't that long. Was, I think, RPG system designers were still questing for how accurately can we model reality? You know, who can come up with the most realistic combat system, the thing that makes the most sense? And again, like I said, that's one of the things that I loved about that James Bond game. I was like, sort of step back from that. I'm like, this isn't reality. A very specific example of that was the James Bond game was the first game that had this idea that later was enshrined in many, many other games of what they called hero points. Of, you know, you've just got these points, and they basically allow you to trump all the dice rolls and everything. So if you need to run across that field with 1,000 Russian soldiers all shooting at you, and fine, you can just do that. And because that's what happens in the movies.
You spend the point.
And that was a very kind of different philosophy. The Doctor Who game system did not endorse that philosophy. It was an outgrowth of the Voss's Star Trek game, as you mentioned. It was a variant on that. The Star Trek system was a very, very, you know, in modern day, if modern players looked at it, it was very board gamey. It was very...
Oh, yeah, I remember rules. You'd open up the rule book, and there's literally stuff showing the hex pattern of a shotgun blast. You need to model your shotgun blast as
it's exactly that sort of stuff. Yeah. When you were in combat, for instance, it very much heavily relied on, you had paper maps and counters, and you'd move space by space. And
combat in a Doctor Who game
is weird. Yeah. And
they're already
really quite fit. Yeah. And all of that. Exactly. And so it tried to simplify the Star Trek system a little bit, but it was very much in that mold, and it was still very kind of board gamey and whatnot.
Okay.
It also, by the way, in retrospect, was put together very, very quickly.
Yes.
So it was, I hate to say it because I had so much fun working on it, but it was a fairly wobbly game system that didn't really work that well for a lot of things. Had some issues.
Certainly they stapled on another gaming, the immediate problem of stapling a set of mechanics that I presume were designed for the Star Trek role-playing game.
Pretty much, yes.
And onto another science fiction genre.
It was the Star Trek role-playing game with one gentleman. His name was John Wheeler. He went into that system and he tried to simplify, and he had some interesting ideas about how to make that a little bit simpler of a game. But it wasn't really play-tested, or, you know, I'm embarrassed to say, I hate to say, it was just kind of put together quickly. It had to get out there, and it had some issues.
Well, Some of the other people you were working in concert with, I wanted to ask you if you had any if you had any truck with these guys, if you had any contact with guys like, well, the first one is J. Andrew and William H. Keith, the Keith brothers, who were sort of famous for their work at Game Designers Workshop. And their, you know, their work for Game Designers Workshop was so massive, it actually spilled out of Game Designers Workshop into FASA.
That's right.
And into other game companies because they were so prolific and such serious fanboys. They loved, clearly they had, they had a massive love for what Game Designers Workshop was doing with Traveler.
Absolutely. In fact, on Doctor Who, the Keith brothers and myself wrote, I think, just about every product.
The like, one other name that came up was Guy L'Amour.
Yeah. So, Guy, he was, I mentioned the game system was based on the Star Trek. Guy was one of the designers of the Star Trek RPG. Guy and a guy by the name of David Teppel, that together they had a company called Fantas Simulations, and they designed the Star Trek RPG for FASA.
Okay.
Did a lot of the Star Trek products. You know, and therefore a little bit involved in this, but
Teppel looks like T-Pool?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. That's right. And so I, of course, as I mentioned before, I wrote, and the reason why I wanted to write Doctor Who was I played a bunch of RPGs. I was very, very obsessed and immersed with them at the time. Played lots of Traveler. I was a huge fan of the Keith brothers. They, too, were somewhere local near Chicago. I mean, I was a kid. I don't know exactly where they lived. I think they lived near Game Designers Workshop, GDW, which was not far from Chicago. It was, you know, again, an Illinois-based company. So they too, I would see on the convention circuit and so forth. I played a lot of Traveler. I was very familiar with what they did. As you said, they were huge, huge Traveler fans, obviously. They were writing so much Traveler material that GDW couldn't even publish it all. And so FASA, the original FASA, existed to publish Traveler stuff.
Yes, like all their stuff.
Third-party Traveler.
All their, the Sky Raiders thing that they did, that trilogy of that campaign trilogy. All that ordeal by Ashar, all exactly. those things were...
Exactly, and their first products were, you know, their founders, one of whom, Jordan Weissman, who I just finished a stint working with on another game, their first products were just deck plans for starships.
I have
sat down and
they're sitting in there. I have every single damn FASA deck plan from 1980-whatever. They're all sitting in a bookshelf.
And in 1983, those were cool as hell. That was the coolest stuff out there.
Yeah, you know? You combine that with all the little cutout counters from Snapshot and Azanti High Lightning, and you had every fight on every starship you could ask for.
Exactly. Only made slightly cooler, by the way, when they did Star Trek, and there were products. These are products I still have today and treasure. The original Enterprise and the Klingon ship from the original Star Trek series, these box sets of deck plans of the entire Enterprise scaled to those counters. Like, you could run around the entire Enterprise, and it's one of the coolest things ever.
One of the best things that came out of that Star Trek.
Yeah, just was these phenomenal deck
was plans. Was that and the ship combat rules, which had, you know, which was, again, board game material.
Yep.
But and not to get too far off of Doctor Who, but unfortunately, Doctor Who never had any battles between D7 battle cruisers and Constitution class, you know, starships. So it fails in that regard. But that was one of the things that I remember. I actually played that.
Yeah,
I played the FASA.
Starship Combat. You know, like I said, I just finished up
Starfleet Battles. Was it called?
Well, that was a separate game. That was an entirely different game. Starfleet Battles.
That wasn't a FASA game.
That was not a FASA game. That was another Star Trek.
My nerd foo fails.
Game. But the original Star Trek RPG had this very, very innovative space. You know the rules itself we were describing them earlier were kind of complex and kind of, you know, nothing would necessarily say Star Trek about them. But where they really got the Star Trek tropes down was in the ship-to-ship combat. And they had this very, very innovative system where an entire game group, you know, all five of you, would pilot one starship together. You each have a little control panel, and each position on the bridge would be responsible for a different thing during the space combat, and you'd have to figure out how to work together. And
I've seen that now in computer games, where now we have computer games where it takes, there was one guy's the engineering department, one guy's weapons.
It was exactly that, and it was very, very interesting in those
paper
days.
Paper counters?
With paper counters, and it was super fun and super super interesting. Right down, and actually, I'll give Star Trek props for this. Like I mentioned, I loved how the Bond game, you know, had mechanics that reinforced the tropes. The Star Trek, the mainline RPG didn't so much have this, but in the space combat rules, for instance, they did have a rule of, like, you know, when your ship would get hit in a certain way, all the crewmen would fall out of their chairs, and therefore nothing could be adjusted for a turn on the thing, and had that, which was very
brace smart, for right? Physical comedy.
And that was exactly that was exactly the sort of thing, like I said, that I was really interested in those days.
All right. So again, as far as guys like Guy L'Amour, and the Keith brothers, you only work with them remote. Did you ever actually meet or talk with these guys while you're working on the project?
I met them all, but not really in the context of Doctor Who. So I met them, you know, because again, sort of like I mentioned my connections to Fossa, they were local guys. You'd see them at the game shows. You'd end up, you know, it was a small enough thing back then. You'd end up playing with them inevitably and doing whatever. But I never actually, like, sat down and had, let's talk about Doctor Who and what you want to do with it and what I want to do with it with any of those guys.
Well, one of the other things you did, besides the, again, you've sort of rather self-deprecatingly referred to the Cybermen source book as being a bit dry by your taste. So you didn't actually, unlike Ford, you didn't come up with a reason why there's second season Cybermen and third season Cybermen and fourth season Cybermen and come up with, you had stats for them.
Yeah.
Well, you statted out every version of Cybermen.
I did come up with that, but it was very dry and boring. Like, you know, they're Cybermen, so they're constantly improving themselves. There's the Mark One and the Mark Two and the Mark Three, and that's why they change appearance during the shows. But it was, you know, I was, like I said, I think that was so much fun to do at the time, but my memory of it, looking back on it, was I was like a 17-year-old kid writing my second book, and what do you know? It wasn't that great.
How dare you tell Doctor Who how to run their Cybermen?
You know, yeah, exactly. It just wasn't that.
Now, there's a rumor that your other scenario you wrote,
right,
the Hardlewick Horror,
yes,
was actually originally written with the intention that it was a Call of Cthulhu scenario, and that it was rejected by Chaosium, and so you revamped it to be a Doctor Who scenario. That was the rumor.
Yeah, so Hardlewick Horror was the third product I wrote for Fossa. It absolutely was not originally written to be
shooting
Call of Cthulhu.
Down.
It was not rejected by Chaosium. Again, what was going on there was I was, you know, trying to mimic the show and the tropes, and in that era, particularly, a very Doctor Who trope was, you know, find some piece of fiction, something, and, you know, some well-known piece of fiction, and rewrite it, recast it in Doctor Who.
For instance, give some examples.
So, for instance, Brain of Morbius, the Tom Baker episode, that's Frankenstein, redone as Doctor Who. There's an episode called The Androids of Tara, which is really Prisoner of Zenda, redone as Doctor
Who. Oh, yes, absolutely.
Like, they would do this over and over again.
Robots of Death, you mentioned before.
Robots of Death, exactly. So, Robots of Death was Agatha Christie's Ten Little Indians, rewritten as a Doctor Who scenario. This is one of the patterns of Doctor Who. Like, find some piece of fiction.
The Talons of Wen Chang.
You know, The Talons of Wen Chang is actually my favorite episode ever.
It's, high five.
It's this brilliant pastiche of everything Victorian. You know, you've got Sherlock Holmes in there, you've got Jack the Ripper in there, you've got all that stuff. But this was the trope, and so I was trying to imitate that. So I, at the time, I said, well, like, let's take this H.P. Lovecraft stuff and let's rewrite it as Doctor Who. In a way, I guess there was a Tom Baker episode called The Image of the Fendahl, which in a way was its own effort to kind of take this H.P. Lovecraft stuff, I guess, and recast his Doctor Who. But that's what it is. So I said, okay, I'm going to, my template is like Brain of Morbius and that sort of stuff. I'm going to take this story. I'm going to reinterpret it as Doctor Who. So it's H.P. Lovecraft. So it's set in the 20s
naturally,
and all of that. And so that what it was, that's what it was. So I think, you know, in retrospect, had I really been trying to write something for Chaosium, it would have been a little bit less on the nose, a little bit less like you know, everything is just pure stereotypical sort of cliche Cthulhu Lovecraft sort of stuff.
Okay. What do you remember about the plot of it? There's obviously we have a people disappearing in Hartlewick. We've got druids.
Yeah, something like that. So what I remember about the plot of it, and this isn't quite 30 years ago, but 28 years ago.
Still says 85 for publication.
I remember it flowing from again, much in the mode of Brain of Morbius or whatever, starting with kind of the Lovecraftian, they're the great old ones and they're imprisoned, there's the great seal that imprisons them, and so you know, so there's the equivalent of Cthulhu imprisoned, the equivalent of the great seal, and it's the 20s because it's Cthulhu and all of that stuff. And you know, I remember that. Actually, one thing I remember, and this is, again, kind of calling out those tropes and trying to recreate those tropes.
Yes.
One thing I remember about that adventure is when it starts, you meet this this character who's just plainly evil. He wears a monocle and he's evil and he's just
the was this the blue-blooded Martinet local lord who's
exactly, yeah, who has the monocle and is clearly like the evil guy and everything. And my editor was like, Ray, you know, really, aren't you kind of tipping your hand? Like, this guy's obviously evil. He wears a monocle.
T-shirt says evil.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, maybe you should kind of tone that down a little bit and you know, again, with the philosophy of reinforcing the tropes. No, that's exactly the point. Like, it's Doctor Who. You know, that guy shows up in every episode. You know he's evil from the get-go.
There's any number of Doctor Who episodes where you know that so-and-so is evil from the moment.
It's very clear. He's the evil
you
guy.
Meet him. Yeah.
There's a very clear evil guy. We know he's the evil guy.
Even if everyone outside of the TARDIS can't see that it's evil. Doctor Who and his companions and
you, the
audience,
viewer, it's very, very obvious.
We know who the evil guy is.
That guy is clearly evil. And again, that was one of those things. Like, yes, I know, but this is the trope. Like, there's always that guy. There's the guy who's, you know, over the top, and that it was very much.
Did he perhaps have a cane as well to go with his monocle?
I don't remember if he had a cane, but he wore a monocle, and I remember the conversation with the editor. You know, he's got a monocle. Like, yes, he has a monocle. He's clearly evil. That's the point. You get it.
Yeah.
And again, I think
a monocle means he's either Prussian or evil or possibly both.
He was both.
Oh, was he a Prussian too? Well, then, yeah, that's
I was going to say he's a German guy with a monocle
and a Cthulhu cultist.
That's a hat trick. And again, I'm pretty sure you show up in the town and something terrible happens and you get blamed for it.
Yeah.
And it turns out that this guy with the monocle, who's German, who everyone thinks is the mayor or whatever, is actually the. Yeah, it was pretty much that.
I'm going to point out that having Germanic people as noblemen in England is not really that far off.
Yeah, sure.
The
exactly.
Mark, what with the House of Hanover only recently having changed their name to Windsor due to the recent unpleasantness in Flanders.
Oh, and actually, this is another Doctor Who trope thing. So I mentioned, you know, it's Call of Cthulhu, but it's set in the 20s. But of course, it's set in England because the Doctor Who TV show, they never had a budget to set anything anywhere other than England.
No, when you go in the past, you're in England.
So, of course, it's England.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, of course, it's England, even though that's not Lovecraft. But it's got to be England because we don't have a budget to go anywhere else, even though it's a role-playing game. And so, I remember this about it as well. Instead of, you know, the fictional Miskatonic University from Call of Cthulhu, it's set at Cambridge University. So it's Cambridge University, it's England, it's the 20s, it's the whole thing. I'm pretty sure there were people going insane and all that, you know, all that Lovecraft stuff like you get from a Doctor Who episode, pastiching it. That was the point.
Very nice. Very nice. I guess we've covered most of the material we attempted to go the first time we attempted this this interview as far as your contributions to the game. Is there anything that you perhaps remember about the game, about other people's contributions, that stood out for either,
sure,
oh my God, thing, the BBC didn't authorize this, or
yeah,
that's a good take on the,
sure,
the source material?
Yeah, I mean, I am pretty sure the BBC didn't really authorize, you know, anything. I mean, of course, they approved the stuff for publication, but they didn't really look at it with near the scrutiny that stuff gets looked
there's
at.
There's a story that Paramount had a certain amount of trouble with Foss's take on Star Trek.
Ultimately, that's true. That was starting to happen around the same time. And there's
about the time that they've pooped out Wrath of Khan, I guess.
It was, well, there were, you know, and this I have less on this, but what I heard, there was a couple of things going on. First of all, there was a constant situation with the Star Trek license of, this was in the era in which Star Trek was just starting to kind of get off the ground again, as you said, more movies, and Gene Roddenberry had his, like, designated guy looking at stuff himself. He didn't own any of the rights, but he had his own guy, like, looking at stuff, and his own guy had problems with a lot of things, and it wasn't clear, you know, as I understand it, just how much authority he had or didn't have or whatever. But around the same time, where the Star Trek license ultimately unwound, you know, right about this time, a couple years later, is when the new TV show started.
Yes.
Star Trek: The Next Generation. And what happened was, at that point, Fossa ran into this problem where there was another Star Trek licensor, or another entity producing Star Trek licensed material, which was Simon & Schuster, part of Viacom,
yes,
who owns Paramount. And they were doing these kind of informational books about Star Trek.
Oh, yes, like the technical manuals.
Like that sort of stuff.
Greg Ginn.
You know, yeah, I mean, I'm less familiar with those, but... You know, they're starting to produce a whole bunch of these things that were basically like a role-playing game source book.
Yeah, encyclopedia, technical manuals.
Without stats.
There's no mechanics, but it's all the intel.
And, you know, at the time, it seems, and again, this is just what I've heard and what I've whatever, like Jordan can give you more background on this, but the Fossa guys realized that, like, you know, there's a huge audience for those, like, people who don't play the role-playing game but want to know, like, what the inside of the Enterprise looks like and all that sort of stuff. And so, in the
Buffy role-playing game that came out always felt like it was merely designed to deliver canon intel to fans rather than actually be a playable role-playing game.
Exactly. And so there was a famous, in the Next Generation era, Fossa produced a couple of products for the Next Generation era of Star Trek. And one of them was just a pure, you know, pure like source material type thing with no game information at all. And they famously, in the last couple of pages, put, and here are the stats for Picard, after like a 100-page book of essentially like a technical manual for the new Next Generation, and it was very much sort of phrased that way. And so what I believe happened was they ran afoul of you know, the licensors, like, that's not your license to do that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, this is clearly you trying to skirt around what your license is. And in fact, famously, one of those, that book that I described was pulled and they couldn't sell it and was destroyed and has become this fairly rare thing that
not quite the E.T. computer game, but close.
Yeah, because this, in fact, was not many fans actually managed to get their hands on this before it was pulled off the market and destroyed. So
now,
that was going on.
Back to Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Again, because the BBC was in no way as involved as Paramount.
In no way, right.
With Star Trek. What were the things that maybe turned up that you remember from 30 years ago, that might have been things that we were like either impressed with or horrified by, as far as, I mean, the first thing I think of is the Celestial Intervention Agency.
Sure, sure. So the Celestial Intervention Agency was actually a semi-clever kind of thing that the designers of the Doctor Who RPG put into place, which was there was a throwaway line in one Doctor Who episode. I think it was the Deadly Assassin Tom Baker episode about this. You know, we all know the lore of Doctor Who is he's the one renegade Time Lord. He's the one guy who's rebelled against the society and has gone out and is interfering in things and
is now being tasked for the dirty work and the sort of deniable ops.
Exactly, and that is the one. And so there's a couple of throwaway references to this Celestial Intervention Agency in this one episode of, you know, maybe there's more than just the Doctor, more inside this Time Lord society. Maybe it's not just him looking at this stuff, and maybe there's this organization that is more actively looking at, you know, things that need to be fixed and changed. And so the designers of that game sort of cleverly saw that as a means by which they could allow players to create their own Time Lord characters that would be doing similar things to what the Doctor does. And so that was one of the backbones of the Doctor Who RPG, that there's this Celestial Intervention Agency out there. You can make any Time Lord you wanted. You two, kind of like the Doctor, were this... you two got involved in things and you interfered with things under the aegis of this Time Lord group that was trying to safeguard history or whatever, was one
well,
of the things.
That alone right there is one of the things that was always to charm me about the game, because it used canon to come up with an excuse why this game wouldn't simply be, I'm playing Tom Baker with Tom Baker stats, or I'm playing Leela with Leela stats, or Harry, or Sarah Jane.
That's right.
You know, and that would have struck me as stunningly boring.
Yeah, well...
I can make my own doctor. He can be named, you know, the plumber. Or whatever.
That
or the
was
mechanic.
One of the things in the early days of these licensed RPGs. You know, I mentioned Star Trek, and was a very early one. The James Bond game we mentioned. Marvel Superheroes was a pretty early licensed RPG. Indiana Jones for TSR. One of the things that...
Oh, yeah, the Indiana Jones game. You just played Indiana Jones.
You just played Indiana Jones. And one of the things that people discovered, the publishers discovered fairly early on, is, you know, The notion that everyone had is like, well, everyone's going to want to be Indiana Jones. Everyone's going to want to be the Doctor in the Marvel superhero. Everyone's going to want to play these Marvel characters.
Yeah, but there's only one Indiana Jones. And there's a group of players.
Yeah, exactly.
Not everyone wants to play Second Banana, Sidekick, Robin.
Absolutely. And you know, even in properties...
Tonto, you know.
Even in properties where that wasn't true, like Marvel, you know, you look back...
At least with Marvel, there's a vast...
And there's
options.
Lots of heroes. And you look back at the early Marvel products, and they were written with the assumption that, like, well, the players are going to want to be the X-Men, or they're going to want to be the Fantastic Four, or whatever. But you go back and look at those early products, and you see there's a pretty quick transition where they realize that, actually, they don't want to be the X-Men. They want to make up their own... They want to be part of this world and part of this universe, but they want to make up their own...
They want to punch Doctor Doom, but they want to do it on their own terms.
They, you know, And in retrospect, that makes sense, because one of the things that distinguishes role-playing games from other types is it's an outlet for creativity. You know, I want to be creative. I want to make my own thing. I want to make my own contribution to
it's not just that you want to be Conan. You want to be in Conan, the situation Conan is in.
I want to add something to Conan's world. I want to carve out my own little piece of it. And so the Doctor Who game was conscious of this from the get-go, and they thought, you know, people need to make their own... You know, people are going to want to make their own characters, so here's a framework that allows you to do that and kind of fit into the canon of the series. You know, in terms of the BBC, the thing that always, you know, that in retrospect, as I became more experienced and I learned more about how this stuff worked, and as the whole market got more mature and licensed games were more commonplace, one of the things that still kind of blows my mind about that era is... There's a very interesting thing about how British television shows worked back in those days, at least, as opposed to their American counterparts, which is back in those days when if you're a writer on Star Trek, you worked under what we call work for hire, which means you wrote the script and Paramount owned your script and Paramount owned the Klingons and owned everything that you created and did all that. But interestingly, that wasn't true in England at the time. That wasn't true with the BBC. And the Doctor Who writers who would write these scripts, they actually owned their own... They owned those those characters and those ideas. That's why, as an example, one of the stumbling blocks to getting Doctor Who back on the air here in this modern era was the BBC had to go and make a deal with the estate of this guy by the name of Terry Nation, who's the guy who created the Daleks. And it's like, you know, you can't have Daleks unless you...
Terry Nation created all kinds of good stuff for the British television.
Absolutely. And the Cybermen, for example, were created by this guy by the name of Kit Pedler and Jerry Davis. I used to do the little puppet, those little puppet.
Gary Anderson,
that's right. And they created the Cybermen, and they owned the rights to the Cybermen and so forth. And
I did not realize that the Cybermen was attached to Space 1999 and Project
same shared and UFO. Creator. Okay. Shared a creator. And you know, the BBC had to do deals with those guys. And you know, this was true up and down the board. And I later learned even so much as, yeah, there was a character who appeared several episodes ago who we want to bring back in this, that necessitated the BBC needed to go to the writer of that.
If you want to see the Brigadier, you're going to have to go to that writer.
You had to do that. When we were working on the Doctor Who RPG, of course, we had zero idea that was the case, and we just freely, there's a character from that one episode who'd work here, so we'd pull him in, and he would do
presumably
all that.
You didn't get any nasty grams from some agent saying, you've used the Brigadier!
I certainly never did, and it never came up anywhere, and you know, and I don't even think Fossa was that conscious.
Well, there is the benefit of being under the radar.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and you're making tens of thousands of dollars.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, and one of the, you know, one of the things perhaps that made licensed RPGs relatively new in that era is before that, you know, quite honestly, nobody even understood that you needed a license to do this. You know, so they would, you know, there'd be a special issue of Dragon Magazine that's all about Conan. And
we all remember that one. Here are his deities and demigods.
And deities and demigods and stuff. Which it turns out, by the way, they did have permission. They did write ahead in Deities and Demigods and said, you know, dear Mr. Moorcock, we'd love to put Elric in this. We think it'd be fun. And he wrote them a letter saying, okay, great, that sounds fantastic, but nobody really understood that you needed any license or anything to do this. It was kind of a new era. So I'm kind of amazed in retrospect, and one of the differences between that era and today is there's no way we could have done that sort of stuff. Like I just no one cared, no one was paying any attention to it.
Well, Pinnacle, is it Pinnacle? I'm suddenly forgetting who it is who's got the new Doctor Who game.
Cubicle
7. Doctor Who Adventures in Time and Space.
Yes, yeah.
I can only, you know, twitch and froth the mouth thinking of the hoops they have to jump through with corporate.
That's very advanced. I understand that they had to one edition when they switched over from David Tennant to Matt Smith, mm-hmm. I understand that they were mandated by the BBC to pull all the old copies of the game off. You know, stop selling that game with David Tennant on the cover, and you have to change everything over. And
you can't sell the old game.
That's my understanding.
That can be brutal.
Yes, and again, like all this stuff, like nowadays, like I said, these entities like the BBC, they all understand how to do this. They all have departments, and there's a methodology. But back then, it was trailblazing, and no one really knew.
The halcyon days of the Wild West.
You know, as a more blatant example of this, so one of the early games that TSR, who published Dungeons & Dragons, one of the early games that they published was a Battle of Five Armies game based on the Battle of Five Armies and The Hobbit.
Nobody called Tolkien up on that.
They had zero license for that at all. Like, back in those, you didn't even understand you needed that. Like, we love this. We're making this game about the Battle of Five Armies.
Remember the, was it Avalon Hills Middle Earth
game? SPI,
and did SPI also do the Battle of Minas Tirith?
I don't remember that. SPI did a War of the Ring game.
There was a Siege of Minas Tirith. I can only wonder if maybe they even bothered talking.
Yeah, SPI, the SPI game was licensed, but interesting, I think it might have been licensed from the Ralph Bakshi stuff. But
I remember
the art from the Ralph Bakshi being on the cover of that.
What I remember is that there was originally a cover, and then the Bakshi movie came out, and then the next edition suddenly has the Bakshi art on the cover as far as whatever was on the cover before. Is there anything else that you want to, I almost think we should end right there on the idea that this you know, this game existed in an environment that is gone. And could never be resurrected.
Totally. And by the way, even when in that era, even when you would go out of your way to get, you know, you mentioned deities and demigods and that kind of thing. It's an old, one of the early D&D supplements that used Michael Moorcock and
Robert Howard and Fritz Lieber.
Exactly. Even in those days, when you would go and actually go to the people who own this and get permission, the nine times out of ten, and the expectation was, is like you just write Fritz Lieber a letter and say, you know what, I think what you're doing is really cool, and you know, we're playing this game, and I'd like to put I'd like to put the Grey Bowser in this game because I think it would be cool, and he would write you a letter back and say, that sounds great, you know, good for you, you go ahead and do that, that's fun,
you go kid, knock like, yourself out.
You know, it was before it was still a hobby and not an industry in a way, and it was very much looked at that way, and so again, I think that was very much the attitude we had on Doctor Who of whatever, do what you will.
Excellent. All right, Mr. Winninger, I think that's it. And God knows that at 54 minutes, I have no doubt they're not going to use all this. I don't know how much they're going to use for the sequence because their average show is an hour.
Yeah.
So I don't even know how much of this they're going to use.
Oh, take some quotes or
I'm sure they will find a way to slice your words up so that you say something like, Tom Baker is a terrible person. You know? Sure. You won't tell it when this is off, you'll tell a Tom Baker story.
I will.
I'm gonna point out that I hope they leave that part in, that there's a terrible Tom Baker story, because people want to know, and we're just not going to tell you. We're just not going to tell you. You're not going to hear the terrible Tom Baker story. All right, thanks, Ray.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. And back over to you in the studio. Tom Baker is a terrible person.